Chapter 4, Fear, by Leslie Alexander and Michelle Alexander. On May 25, 2020, a black man named George Floyd was forced to the ground by several Minneapolis police officers. He remained there, pinned for more than 9 minutes, as Officer Derek Chauvin pressed his knee into Floyd's neck, killing him slowly, even as he begged for his life and called out to his dead mother. Just a short time before, a clerk at a convenience store had called 911, claiming that Floyd had purchased cigarettes with a counterfeit $20 bill. Minutes after police arrived on the scene, Floyd was dead. In the days after the killing, a viral video of the murder sparked widespread outrage, and yet none of the officers responsible for Floyd's death were arrested or faced criminal charges. A pattern that felt, to many in Minneapolis and beyond, painfully familiar. Nationwide, police officers are rarely arrested or charged when they kill, and black people are significantly more likely to be killed by the police than white people. Public attention to this issue had been growing since 2014, when Officer Darren Wilson shot and killed an unarmed black teenager named Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, igniting a major uprising in Ferguson and protests from coast to coast. Wilson was never criminally charged for that killing. 2 years later, in Falcon Heights, less than 10 miles from where Floyd was killed, a 32-year-old black man named Philando Castile was shot and killed during a traffic stop. No officers were found guilty of any wrongdoing, even though that tragedy was live-streamed on social media and provoked a national outcry. And just 2 months before Floyd's death, a 26-year-old black woman named Breonna Taylor was killed in her Louisville, Kentucky apartment when white plainclothes officers, searching for evidence against a suspected drug dealer, broke into her apartment in the middle of the night with a battering ram and sprayed her home with bullets. Again, no officers were held accountable for the killing. All of these killings were officially justified, according to law enforcement and public officials, by fear. Fear of black people who were viewed as threats by the police. When it appeared that, yet again, the police would be allowed to kill a black person with impunity, the rage and grief in the streets of Minneapolis became combustible. 2 days after Floyd's death, Derek Chauvin, the officer who killed him, was still free, despite the videos circulating around the globe revealing beyond any reasonable doubt that Chauvin had murdered a defenseless black man whom he was sworn to serve and protect. Peaceful protests evolved into outright rebellion as residents began throwing bricks, bottles, rocks, and Molotov cocktails at police precincts and cruisers, looting retail stores and burning buildings to the ground. By the time Officer Chauvin was arrested on May 29th, 4 days after Floyd was killed, it was too late. The uprisings had already spread, and multiple cities were aflame. Fresh kindling had been laid in the months and years prior. Decades of false political promises, desperate living conditions, simmering racial tensions, mass criminalization in black communities, and failed efforts at police reform fueled a brief wave of political violence in cities across the country in the days that followed. Protesters recognized that white fear of the racial other is not limited to the police or even to our criminal injustice system, but is endemic to our society as a whole. In fact, just weeks before Floyd was murdered, another viral video had revealed to the nation and much of the world that white fear is easily and routinely weaponized by ordinary people with potentially deadly consequences. In this case, the video showed how Ahmaud Arbery, a 25-year-old black man, was chased by three white vigilantes as he jogged in a predominantly white neighborhood near Brunswick, Georgia, and was then shot and killed by one of them. The men claimed they suspected that Arbery had robbed homes in the area, but he had merely been jogging in a place where white men believed that he didn't belong. For many, that tragedy was reminiscent of yet another killing, the 2012 shooting of Trayvon Martin, a 17-year-old black high school student in Sanford, Florida. Martin had been walking through a gated community carrying nothing more than a package of Skittles and a cold drink when he was stalked and killed by George Zimmerman, a volunteer neighborhood watchman who found Martin's presence in the neighborhood suspicious. His death prompted waves of protests and racial justice organizing, as well as a slew of viral videos showing police killings, vigilante threats, and attacks upon black people who were doing nothing more than living their lives, trying to be free. Yet the threats and violence continued unabated. Just hours before George Floyd took his last breath, yet another video had gone viral, this one showing a white woman in New York City dialing 911. Falsely claiming that a black man named Christian Cooper was endangering her. The incident began when Cooper, who was bird-watching in Central Park, asked the woman to put a leash on her dog in accordance with park rules. When she became hostile, Cooper recorded the encounter, which shows him calmly speaking to the woman as she threatens to tell the police that there's an African-American man threatening my life. By the time Floyd was murdered, pervasive police violence and the tragic consequences of white fear of black people had become undeniable in the eyes of many Americans. In the weeks and months that followed, thousands upon thousands of protesters took to the streets in all 50 states, in large cities like Los Angeles, Chicago, Detroit, Atlanta, and New York, as well as in suburbs, small and medium-sized towns, and rural areas. Protests erupted even in places as far away as Hong Kong, South Africa, Germany, South Korea, and New Zealand. Never before had a black rebellion been met with such widespread support by people of all colors, classes, and walks of life. After an initial wave of violence, these protests were overwhelmingly peaceful. The demonstrators were determined to make their voices heard and to show a united front against racism and police violence. People gathered by the dozens, the hundreds, or the thousands in parks and city centers, or marched to municipal buildings like police departments and city halls, while chanting slogans, carrying signs, and demanding justice. Of the more than 7,750 demonstrations that took place in the United States between May 26 and August 22, nearly 95% were nonviolent, according to the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project. Fewer than 220 locations reported any form of violent demonstrations. In the tally, that term was defined to include any acts of vandalism, including graffiti and toppling of statues, property destruction, or violence of any kind against individuals. But the response by police was brutal, encouraged by President Donald Trump, who condemned the protests, blasted the Black Lives Matter slogan, calling it a symbol of hate, and pledged his allegiance to law and order. Images filled television screens and social media feeds of police officers and federal agents, at times joined by white nationalist organizations like the Proud Boys, attacking peaceful protesters, beating them with batons, using pepper spray and pellets, chasing them down streets and alleys, driving cars into crowds, and forcing people into unmarked vehicles. During mass protests in Wisconsin, a white 17-year-old from Illinois named Kyle Rittenhouse, who considered himself a militia member, traveled to the city of Kenosha to assist the police. In a video, he was seen carrying a military-style rifle and chatting with police officers, who thanked him for his service and gave him water, not long before he shot 3 people, killing 2. Ultimately, the federal government sent more than 17,000 members of the National Guard to patrol the streets in 23 states and Washington, D.C. When protesters gathered at the Lincoln Memorial, dozens of National Guard officers lined up in rows to defend federal property. They were among the hundreds stationed throughout the city at other sites. Those same troops were nowhere in sight months later when an overwhelmingly white mob, composed of white nationalists and Trump supporters, stormed the United States Capitol, smashing windows and ransacking offices while lawmakers were in the process of certifying President-elect Joseph Biden's electoral victory. For months, President Trump had falsely claimed that the 2020 presidential election had been rigged against him, ultimately leading his supporters to converge on the Capitol in an effort to overturn the results. More than 100 police officers were assaulted during the mayhem. 5 people died, including 1 officer. But despite many warnings that the crowd on January 6 could turn violent, the National Guard was not deployed until after the rioting had already begun. Police presence at the Capitol was light, too. Some officers were even seen letting the insurrectionists approach the building and standing aside as the mob poured inside. The glaring double standard reflects a centuries-old pattern in which black strivings for liberation have been demonized, criminalized, and subjected to persecution, while white people's demands for liberty are deemed rational, legitimate, and largely unthreatening. As James Baldwin explained a half century earlier, when any white man in the world says, "Give me liberty or give me death," the entire white world applauds. When a black man says exactly the same thing, word for word, he is judged a criminal and treated like one. And everything possible is done to make an example of this bad nigger so there won't be any more like him. There has never been a time in United States history when black rebellions did not spark existential fear among white people, often leading to violent response. Even when resistance has been peaceful or purely symbolic, such as black fists raised during the medal ceremony at the 1968 Olympics, or a knee taken on the football field during the national anthem nearly 50 years later, any sign of rebellion has frequently resulted in threats or acts of violence perpetrated by white vigilantes, militia groups, and the police, often culminating in the creation or strengthening of systems of racial and social control. The reflexive impulse to respond to black people with severe punitiveness is traceable to the 18th and 19th centuries, when white people desperately sought to control a large, unfree population who refused to submit to their enslavement. The deep-seated, gnawing terror that black people might one day rise up and demand for themselves the same freedoms and inalienable rights that led white colonists to declare the American Revolution has shaped our nation's politics, culture, and systems of justice ever since. The specific forms of repression and control may have changed over time, but the underlying pattern established during slavery has remained the same. Modern-day policing, surveillance, and mass criminalization, as well as white vigilante violence and know-your-place aggression, have histories rooted in white fear, not merely of black crime or black people, but of black liberation. Nothing has proved more threatening to our democracy or more devastating to black communities than white fear of black freedom dreams. Most school children are taught the Declaration of Independence's most famous lines: "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." But relatively few children or adults today are as familiar with the right to revolt that follows. Whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it. When a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. When Thomas Jefferson penned those words, he owned hundreds of enslaved people. Yet he was acutely aware that black people yearned for freedom no less than the white colonists who had waged the American Revolution, and that no principle of justice could defend slavery. Even God, he later claimed, would likely side with enslaved people if they organized a successful revolt against their enslavers. In Notes on the State of Virginia, published in 1785, Jefferson admitted that rebellions were a legitimate, rational response to an immoral and inhumane system. I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, that his justice cannot sleep forever, that considering numbers, nature, and natural means only, a revolution of the will of fortune, an exchange of situation is among possible events, that it may become probable by supernatural interference. Jefferson's anxious reflections were a kind of inheritance, something passed down from generation to generation among uneasy white enslavers. At the heart of slavery lay a terrifying conundrum, an epic struggle between the enslavers who sought to extract labor, loyalty, and submission from their human property, and the enslaved people who longed for freedom and were willing to obtain their liberation by any means necessary. Jefferson, whose ancestors had been enslaving Africans on large Virginia plantations since the 17th century, understood this dilemma well. Slavery, he once quipped, was akin to having a wolf by the ear. White people could not release their grip on it, but they also knew that beneath the surface boiled a formidable black rage that could not be fully contained. From the founding of the original 13 colonies, white people in the North and South lived in constant fear that the men and women they whipped, raped, and forced to work without pay would, if given the chance, rise up and take revenge on their white enslavers. This is why governmental surveillance and severe punishment of black people began almost concurrently with the introduction of slavery itself. In 1669, the Carolina colony granted every free white man absolute power and authority over his Negro slaves. Within decades, Carolina law drastically bolstered white authority, mandating that all white people ought to be responsible for policing all black people's activities. Any white person who failed to properly monitor suspicious black activity would be fined 40 shillings. This notion that black people were inherently devious and criminal, and that white people were required to monitor and police them, ultimately defined the nature of race relations in the United States. Convinced that the prevailing social and economic order could be preserved only if black people were objects of perpetual surveillance and control, authorities across the colonies enacted slave codes, laws that governed black people's lives and denied them basic human rights, including the rights to move freely, to resist any white person, and to carry weapons of any kind. Failure to adhere to these restrictions resulted in brutal punishment. Early slave codes also legally empowered enslavers to beat, maim, assault, or even kill an enslaved person without penalty. And if found guilty of participating in insurrectionary activity, an enslaved person would automatically receive the death penalty. In many colonies, such as Virginia, the public treasury was even required to compensate enslavers if an enslaved person was killed while resisting or running away. Even so, these efforts proved insufficient. In the colonial era alone, 50 documented conspiracies against slavery were identified in the mainland British colonies, and nearly 50 more in the British Caribbean. On April 6, 1712, for example, approximately 24 enslaved men and women gathered in New York City in the early morning hours. Armed with guns, axes, clubs, and knives, they set a building ablaze, hoping to inspire panic. When unsuspecting white people arrived to douse the flames, the rebels ambushed them, killing 9 and wounding 7 others. The rebellion was quickly quashed. 21 people were executed. Some were burned at the stake, while others were hanged in chains or had their necks snapped. One rebel was strapped to a large stone wheel, each of his bones broken with a wooden mallet, while he screamed in agony, and then he was left to die painfully. Fearful of just these sorts of rebellions, colonists at the turn of the 18th century created civilian-based systems of law enforcement. Initially, these patrols were reminiscent of the Posse Comitatus in England, in which bands of men were called out to chase down and arrest people suspected of felony crimes. It soon became clear, however, that an ad hoc voluntary system was wholly inadequate for the challenge of controlling thousands of enslaved people, especially in places like the Carolina Colony, where enslaved people outnumbered white people. Eventually, white colonists devised a new law enforcement institution, one that would serve, to a significant degree, as the foundation for modern policing, the Slave Patrol. The first official slave patrol was created in South Carolina in 1704, following rumors of a planned rebellion. As the historian Sally Haddon writes in her comprehensive study, Slave Patrols, colonists, already fearful of attack by the Spanish in Florida, concluded that they needed 2 military forces, a militia to repel foreign enemies, and a patrol to leave behind as a deterrent against slave revolts. Every militia captain would select a group of men under his command to serve as patrollers, a separate unit that was responsible for enforcing slave codes. Patrollers were required to hunt fugitives and rebellious enslaved people and to visit every plantation at least once a month. There, they invaded slave cabins, confiscating any items they believed to be stolen, as well as anything they judged could be used as a weapon. By the late 1720s, slave patrolling in the Carolina colony had become a fundamental part of the militia's regular duties. Virginia and North Carolina soon created their own slave patrols, and by the mid-18th century, colonial authorities there had transformed groups of white settlers, who were recruited and handsomely rewarded, into a militarized law enforcement organization that, as Haddon notes, was primarily engaged in watching, catching, or beating black slaves. Patrollers enforced slave codes and routinely broke into the homes of enslaved people, aggressively searching them and their quarters, and subjecting women to sexual violence. Everywhere the pattern was the same. White people enslaved, raped, terrorized, and murdered black people, mostly for profit, and also to enforce a rigid racial hierarchy in which they maintained both status and power. Black people resisted and rebelled, often violently. White fear of black rebellion soared after each rumored or attempted revolt, leading to heightened surveillance, brutal patrolling, and new waves of laws or policies that aimed to permanently subdue the enslaved population. The Stono Rebellion offers a dramatic example. On September 9, 1739, in South Carolina, 20 enslaved Africans gathered near the Stono River, some 10 miles southwest of Charleston, where they plotted their revolt. Led by a man named Jimmy, They raided a local store, grabbing weapons and ammunition, and then marched from plantation to plantation, killing nearly 30 enslavers as they burned and raided their properties. Using drums and other musical instruments, the rebels attracted supporters, and soon the uprising blossomed to more than 100 persons. When the local militia caught wind of the attacks, they hunted down the rebels and successfully quelled the revolt. Dozens of enslaved people lay dead. Heads were displayed on massive wooden poles at every milepost leading to Charleston as a ghoulish warning that the cost of resistance would be death. Over the next few months, South Carolina officials arrested more than 150 black people, publicly hanging 10 per day. South Carolina legislators, enraged and horrified by the black insurrection, passed the Negro Act of 1740, which was designed to force enslaved people into due subjection and obedience, and to save the public peace and order. The legislation aimed to go further than any previous form of racial control by authorizing the policing of nearly every aspect of black people's lives. The act prohibited enslaved people from moving beyond the boundaries of their plantations, assembling in groups on roads, growing their own food, or earning money. And it imposed harsh penalties on enslaved people who learned to read. It also empowered constables to deputize any white person to disperse any assembly or meeting of slaves which may disturb the peace or endanger the safety of His Majesty's subjects, and to search all suspected places for arms, ammunition, or stolen goods, and to apprehend and secure all such slaves as they shall suspect to be guilty of any crimes or offenses whatsoever. In an effort to reinforce universal white authority over black people, lawmakers also empowered all white people to pursue, apprehend, and moderately correct any black person who refused to submit to their authority. If any enslaved persons tried to defend themselves, they could be lawfully killed. In the years that followed, South Carolina's Negro Act became a model for slave codes throughout the colonies, governing black lives for more than a century. Such laws existed in the northern colonies as well, even though the enslaved population was comparatively small. In New York, for example, authorities banned enslaved people from gathering in groups larger than three, holding funerals at night, being out after sunset without a lantern, selling food in the streets, playing musical instruments, or associating with free black people. Enslaved black people weren't even allowed to simply ride a horse for fear they would use the horse to escape. Northerners also implemented strict curfew laws, which targeted all black people, enslaved and free. Legislation in Connecticut and Rhode Island, for example, explicitly encouraged anti-black vigilantism by authorizing any white person to capture an enslaved person who appeared to be out after nine without specified permission. These oppressive laws did not cease after the collapse of British rule. Instead, government policing of black communities, free and enslaved, persisted throughout the American Revolution and became state law once the United States gained its independence. However, no amount of brutal repression could prevent enslaved people from dreaming of and fighting for freedom. And no quest for liberation would terrify white Americans more than the one that would take place on a small island in the Caribbean about 15 years after the United States was founded. In 1791, just 700 miles from U.S. shores, enslaved men and women in France's most profitable colony, Saint-Domingue, unleashed a rebellion. The revolt should have surprised no one. Like many other colonies in the Americas, Saint-Domingue's main cash crop was sugar. Planting, growing, and harvesting it required intense labor performed in sweltering heat under the constant pain of the lash. Processing sugar was equally grueling, often pushing enslaved people to exhaustion, injury, and dismemberment as they labored throughout the night to feed the cane stalks through the mills. More than half of the men and women imported into Saint-Domingue, directly from the African continent, died within a few years, and those who survived were typically subjected to harsh punishments and outright torture. Following a whipping, enslaved people in Saint-Domingue were often burned with an open flame, while others were subjected to burning wax, hot coals, or boiling cane juice. Some were even buried alive. The conditions for rebellion were especially ripe on the island, since the enslaved people there, the largest enslaved population in the Caribbean, far outnumbered the white enslavers and colonizers. Gathering nightly over several days in mid-August in the northern region of Saint-Domingue, enslaved people painstakingly planned an insurrection, a revolutionary war against their white enslavers that they intended to fight to the death in order to reclaim their human right to freedom. Duty Boukman, an enslaved man and a highly respected spiritual leader, assembled hundreds of enslaved people in the woods at Bois Quemin and led them in a religious ceremony, calling upon their God to guide them and sealing their revolutionary pact with oaths and ritual sacrifices. On the night of August 21st, 1791, rebels began seizing their freedom. Spreading rapidly across the northern region over the next 2 days, nearly 2,000 rebels marched from plantation to plantation, armed with machetes, burning and destroying workhouses and other buildings, and killing their oppressors. Within a week, French authorities believed nearly 10,000 enslaved people had joined the revolt, and it seemed unstoppable. "We were attacked by a horde of assassins," one plantation manager later wrote, "and could offer only meager resistance." By the end of September, more than 1,000 plantations had been burned, and hundreds of white people lay dead. Eventually expanding to an estimated 80,000 rebels, the revolt erupted into the largest, bloodiest, and most successful rebellion of enslaved people in history. White enslavers throughout the world recoiled in shock and horror. Enslaved people were rising up and asserting their determination to be free at any cost. In the United States, the world's newest slave-holding republic, President George Washington and the other founding fathers openly panicked, nervously speculating about whether the spirit of rebellion would be infectious enough to afflict their fledgling nation. Politicians throughout the country expressed outrage and horror as black people in a neighboring nation sought their own liberty, even as they basked in the glow of their own revolution, during which they had sought to free themselves from tyranny and oppression. Just weeks after the rebellion in Saint-Domingue began, Charles Pinckney, the governor of South Carolina, warned President Washington that similar uprisings would soon spread to the southern United States and devastate the economy. "I am afraid," Pinckney wrote to Washington, "that if the insurrection is not checked in time, it is a flame which will extend to all the neighboring islands and may eventually prove not a very pleasing or agreeable example to the southern states, and be particularly unpleasant to us who live in countries where slaves abound." By the end of 1791, Washington had finally succumbed to the growing panic. "Lamentable to see such a spirit of revolt among the blacks," Washington exclaimed. "Where it will stop is difficult to say." Thomas Jefferson also fretted about the formidable insurrection in Saint-Domingue, as did Alexander Hamilton, who expressed regret about the calamitous event taking place just a short distance away. As the uprising unfolded in Haiti, rumors of potential revolts in the United States spread like wildfire, prompting desperate new measures to prevent and thwart rebellions by the enslaved. Authorities in Charleston, South Carolina, for example, tried to protect themselves by banning the importation of French enslaved people. In Richmond, Virginia, the mayor mandated a search of all enslaved people in the city and enlisted extra patrols throughout the remainder of the state. On the federal level, in 1793, lawmakers passed a fugitive slave law, clearly warning enslaved people that rebellion or flight was useless, as they would find no paths to freedom in the United States. The new legislation empowered enslavers to cross state lines to pursue and recapture enslaved people escaping from the service of their masters. It also imposed a fine on anyone who prevented the capture and return of a fugitive from slavery. Meanwhile, the flames of insurrection continued to burn brightly in Saint-Domingue. Toussaint Louverture, who had assumed leadership of the rebellion and his army successfully held off military invasions from the French, Spanish, and British, the greatest military powers on earth at the time. In 1794, the French National Convention agreed to abolish slavery throughout Saint-Domingue, hoping it would quell the resistance. But peace did not return. Saint-Domingue remained under French control. Formerly enslaved people still labored under oppressive plantation systems, and rebels persisted in their demand for full freedom, equality, and sovereignty for all black people. Emboldened by the uprisings in Saint-Domingue, free and enslaved black people in Martinique, Curaçao, Jamaica, Grenada, and many other slaveholding colonies, including Spanish Louisiana, demanded their freedom and proved that they, too, were willing to sacrifice their lives to obtain it. By the late 1790s, it had become clear that the rebellion in Saint-Domingue could not be contained. White politicians in the United States grew increasingly alarmed. In a letter to Thomas Jefferson, one prominent Virginian, Arthur Campbell, expressed his concern that the Saint-Domingue Rebellion would lead to similar calamities in Virginia. If that happened, he warned, the United States would rapidly decline. Henry Tazewell, a U.S. senator from Virginia, apparently agreed, anxiously urging Jefferson to recognize that people from Saint-Domingue gave the southern states much to dread. Fear permeated the highest levels of government, and in 1799, Secretary of State Timothy Pickering urgently wrote to President John Adams, arguing that in the interest of national security, the United States must use all necessary measures to prevent black revolt. Our southern states are yet in much danger from attempts to excite the blacks to insurrection. It is essential, he urged, to guard against the danger to be apprehended from Saint Domingo. The fear was well-founded. Enslaved people in the United States and across the Americas saw themselves as part of a joint struggle for freedom. As news of insurrections traveled across the water, the following year, an enslaved man in Virginia named Gabriel was inspired by the uprising in Saint-Domingue to hatch an insurrection of his own, which reportedly grew to several hundred conspirators. As Virginia governor and future president, James Monroe, himself an enslaver, wrote in a letter to Vice President Thomas Jefferson, "It is unquestionably the most serious and formidable conspiracy we have ever known of the kind." Although traitors betrayed Gabriel's plot before the rebellion could fully materialize, Virginia responded by further restricting black people's lives. Governor Monroe ordered the state militia to patrol the capital, sweep the region, and arrest any enslaved person they deemed suspicious. White Virginians also strengthened the slave codes, hoping that strict surveillance and control over gatherings would stymie the ability of black people to plot and execute rebellions. They further circumscribed the movements of enslaved people, explicitly preventing gatherings on Sundays or in the evenings, and banning education and literacy among the enslaved. The new law also required black people freed by their owners to leave the state within 12 months or face re-enslavement. In Virginia, then, to be black was to be enslaved. To be free and black was to be a threat. Nevertheless, the black sovereignty that white Americans feared most eventually came to pass. On November 29, 1803, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, the new leader of the rebel army in Saint-Domingue, declared victory in the revolution against French authority. Weeks later, he publicly unveiled l'Acte de la Dépendance d'Haïti, the Act of Independence of Haiti, officially introducing Haiti to the world as a sovereign nation. In a speech delivered in the port city of Gonaïves, Dessalines called upon his people to pledge themselves to liberty at any cost. "Let us swear before the whole universe, to posterity, to ourselves," he urged, "to renounce France forever and to die rather than live under its dominion. To fight until our last breath for the independence of our country." The announcement sent shockwaves around the world. Slavery and Saint-Domingue had provided France with nearly half of its global trade profit on an annual basis, and by 1791, Saint-Domingue was the world's largest producer of coffee and sugar. Although France had fought desperately to maintain its power to exploit and control the black population, the rebels had managed to defeat Napoleon's army, reportedly the greatest military power on earth, and declare their independence less than 3 decades after American colonists declared their own. In establishing their own nation, black rebels had accomplished what the scholar Michel Rolf Triot has described as the unthinkable. After all, Haiti became the first and only country in the Americas where enslaved Africans threw off their shackles, fought for their freedom, defeated European powers, established their own nation, and pledged to defend their freedom and independence until their last breath. The Haitian Act of Independence radically upended the basic premise of white supremacy upon which slavery rested, and asserted black people's fundamental human rights to liberty and self-governance. The emergence of a sovereign black nation, rising from the ashes of France's most profitable slave colony, represented the culmination of white people's deepest fears and black people's deepest hopes. After all, if the enslaved in Haiti could have a successful rebellion, defeat multiple armies, and establish a sovereign country, couldn't the same thing happen elsewhere? Perhaps in their very midst? White people in the United States did not have to wait long for answers to these questions. Embracing sovereign Haiti as a symbol for global black freedom, enslaved people in the United States waged their own battles for liberation. Multiple revolts erupted in the early 19th century, nearly all of them inspired in some way by the Haitian Revolution. In 1811, black people rose up in Louisiana and were brutally suppressed in what became known as the German Coast Rebellion. About a decade later, in 1822, political officials in Charleston, South Carolina, reported that Denmark Vesey, a free black abolitionist, had developed a plot with other rebels to undermine slavery and escape to Haiti. Although that revolt never fully came to fruition, and some historians have contested its existence, the rumors of insurrection terrified white Americans and led to the bloody executions of 35 alleged conspirators, including Vesey. As a correspondent to President Thomas Jefferson noted, Who can reflect on the scenes of Saint Domingo and of often occurrences among you of now one and then another murdered by his slaves, houses fired, and not wonder when the next uprising would come? And then, about a decade later, on August 21st, 1831, Nat Turner, an enslaved man in Virginia who believed that slavery violated God's law and that God had selected him to lead his people to freedom, unleashed a bloody rebellion. Over the next 2 days, he and his followers, which included several free black people, attacked farms and killed some 60 white enslavers throughout Southampton County. The local militia, joined by troops from the United States Navy, which was anchored nearby, murdered at least 100 black rebels in an effort to suppress the uprising. Turner himself remained at large for 6 weeks, but he was eventually captured, hung, skinned, and brutally dismembered. While Turner was still free, however, roving gangs of white men attacked black people in Southampton and nearby counties, killing as many as 200, to ensure that black rebels would not dare to attempt another revolt. One observer wrote that white vigilantes formed themselves into patrol bands and went wherever they chose among the colored people, acting out their brutal will. Virginia lawmakers also surrendered to fear, although in the aftermath of Turner's rebellion, they briefly considered abolishing slavery. They ultimately elected, once again, to pass draconian laws severely restricting black people's lives. Aware that literacy inspired black people's strivings for freedom, and that religious gatherings were used as opportunities to plot rebellions, lawmakers augmented punishments for enslaved people who learned to read, held unsupervised religious gatherings, or interacted with free black people. In the decade following Nat Turner's rebellion, as rural areas struggled to suppress the enslaved population, southern cities concluded that the only way to protect their residents from uprisings in surrounding areas was to invest in armed patrols. In most urban areas, after establishing a city patrol, officials would also build a town jail and a punishment site, often referred to as the cage, where suspicious enslaved people could be incarcerated and tortured. By 1837, the patrol in Charleston, South Carolina, comprised 100 armed officers who policed free and enslaved black communities, captured fugitives, prevented rebellions, and enforced the slave codes. Legally free black people, in both the North and the South, were subjected to similar forms of surveillance and terrorism. Lawmakers across the nation enacted legislation to ensure that free black people would remain firmly in their place at the bottom of the social order, foreshadowing the "know your place" aggression that would dominate race relations in the 20th and 21st centuries. White politicians outlawed any black behavior that was not immediately recognizable as labor or subservience. In Louisiana, for example, it was illegal for free people of color to conceive themselves equal to the whites. As the law explicitly stated, black people should yield to white people on every occasion and never speak or answer them but with respect. If legally free black people failed to submit to white authority, they were subject to imprisonment. By the time the Civil War began in 1861, Southern states had established an elaborate governing framework for race relations. Through trial and error, as well as careful planning, white authorities had created oppressive laws and systems of patrolling, surveillance, and punishment, all of which were designed to protect enslavers and the white citizenry from the consequences of their own unmitigated violence, and to ensure centuries of prosperity for the planter elite. If the Confederacy had been a separate nation when the Civil War began, it would have ranked among the richest in the world. As the historian Stephen Diley writes in Carry Me Back, The Domestic Slave Trade in American Life, the monetary value of the enslaved population in 1860 was equal to about 7 times the total value of all currency in circulation in the country, 3 times the value of the entire livestock population, 12 times the value of the entire U.S. cotton crop, and 48 times the total expenditures of the U.S. federal government that year. Ultimately, the war ended the South's economic power, but it did not reduce white fear of black liberation or the perpetual quest for racial control. To the contrary, white fear and paranoia grew as Southern white people lost control over the black population in their midst. Formerly enslaved people literally walked away from their plantations, causing panic and outrage among plantation owners. Large numbers took to the streets and highways in the early years after the war, looking for work and missing family members. Some converged on towns and cities. Others joined and formed militias. Many white people feared violent reprisals or a turning of the tables, now that black people had access to arms and ammunition and were no longer subject to perpetual surveillance and control by white plantation owners. Violent insurrection, however, was not the only fear seizing the minds of many white Southerners in the aftermath of the Civil War. White people of all classes and backgrounds feared permanent economic ruin, a disordered social system, and the loss of white privilege. Without the stolen labor of formerly enslaved people, the region's economy swiftly collapsed, and without the institution of slavery, there was no longer a formal mechanism for maintaining racial hierarchy and preventing amalgamation with a group of people considered intrinsically inferior and vile. Plantation owners had benefited the most from the institution of slavery, yet the collapse of the racial order was a bitter pill for poor white people as well. In the antebellum South, the lowliest white person at least possessed his or her white skin, a badge of superiority over the most skilled, enslaved, or prosperous free black person. Poor white people feared that the abolition of slavery would erase the line that separated them from the most abused and despised people on earth. Any stride toward freedom by black people provoked alarm throughout the South, as any perceived increase in black political and economic power triggered white fears of losing power and status. Although many white Northerners supported voting rights and other basic civil rights for black people, at least initially, white Southerners overwhelmingly opposed any move toward greater freedom or equality for the black people in their midst. In the years that followed the Civil War, white Southerners employed a wide range of weapons, legal and extra-legal, to restore their control over rebellious black people and return them to their place. Southern states swiftly reinvented their tools for racial control and enacted black codes that were akin to the old slave codes. As expressed by one Alabama planter, "We have the power to pass stringent police laws to govern the Negroes. This is a blessing, for they must be controlled in some way, or white people cannot live amongst them." Some of the black codes foreshadowed Jim Crow laws by policing the movement of black people whose recent emancipation had become a perpetual source of fear and resentment. These codes segregated schools and prohibited, for example, interracial seating in the first-class sections of railroad cars. Other codes were intended to establish systems of peonage resembling slavery to ensure a cheap labor force. Vagrancy laws were adopted and selectively enforced against black people. These essentially made it a criminal offense not to work, often forcing formerly enslaved people to sign labor contracts with the same people who had once enslaved them. Simply being black and standing on a street corner could be interpreted as idleness or vagrancy by the police and result in arrest. In several states, convict leasing laws allowed the hiring out of people in county prisons to plantation owners and private companies in an unsubtle effort to establish another system of forced labor. In the words of W.E.B. Du Bois, the code spoke for themselves. No open-minded student can read them without being convinced they meant nothing more nor less than slavery and daily toil. Perhaps most disconcerting for white Southerners was the prospect of black people holding political power over white people, and thus gaining the opportunity to rewrite the rules, overturn exploitative economic arrangements, and redesign the social and political order. With the passage of the Reconstruction Act in 1867, followed by the 15th Amendment, guaranteeing that the right to vote shall not be denied or abridged on the basis of race, an era of rising black power began. For nearly a decade, black people voted in huge numbers across the South, electing a total of 16 black men to serve in the U.S. Congress, including 2 in the Senate. Literacy rates climbed, and educated black people began to populate state legislatures, open schools, and initiate successful businesses. Tragically, the black freedom dreams that propelled swift progress toward equality were arrested by the late 1870s as a fierce white backlash against black freedom succeeded in turning back the clock on racial progress. Southern white people effectively nullified the post-Civil War amendments that were intended to dismantle the racial caste system in the South, including the 14th Amendment, guaranteeing equal protection of the laws, and the 15th Amendment. The Freedmen's Bureau, an agency created by Congress in 1865 and charged with the responsibility of providing food, clothing, and other forms of assistance to destitute former enslaved people, was dismantled, and a plethora of discriminatory practices, such as poll taxes and literacy tests, were employed to prevent black people from exercising their right to vote and gaining political power. When those efforts proved insufficient to maintain complete control, white Southerners wielded their most effective weapon, vigilante violence and terrorism. In 1898, for example, a group of white residents orchestrated a successful coup to overthrow the city government in Wilmington, North Carolina, home to a thriving majority black population. 4 years earlier, the populist movement had joined with the Republican Party to form the Fusion Party, a political organization that managed to unite poor and working-class white people, formerly enslaved people and their descendants, and liberal Republicans in a movement for economic justice. This racially diverse party defeated old guard politicians, many of whom were white supremacists and former Confederates, in a series of state and local elections, including in places like Wilmington. In response, the disgruntled white establishment plotted a coup to regain power and reinstate white-only rule that culminated in the murder of black residents, burning of black neighborhoods, and the unveiling of a white Declaration of Independence at a mass meeting led by a former congressman. Throughout the South, local police forces were often made up of former slave patrollers and members of the Ku Klux Klan, and they adopted many of the same strategies that patrollers had employed, using the excuse of nightly curfews and vagrancy laws to control, harass, detain, and punish black citizens for daring to behave as though they were free. The Klan, operating extra-legally, openly murdered black people who violated the written and unwritten rules of white supremacy. Often the precise causes and triggers of white fear and rage were mixed or unclear, but the consequences were always devastating, Between 1877 and 1950, more than 4,000 black men, women, and children lost their lives to lynching. Fleeing violence, harsh segregation laws, and exploitative economic conditions, many black Americans headed north in what would become known as the Great Migration, to take advantage of the need for industrial workers that arose during the First World War, and to achieve some modicum of safety. Unfortunately, many soon realized that white mob violence reigned there as well. One of the bloodiest race massacres in the 20th century occurred in East St. Louis, Illinois, in 1917. That tragedy involved a spree of lynchings, mayhem, and brutal burnings of people and buildings that left an official death toll of at least 39 black and 8 white Americans, though historians estimate that more than 100 black people were actually killed. White fear of the disruption of the racial order meant that almost any act by a black person, especially anything that signaled black progress or the willingness of a black person to step out of their place in the racial hierarchy, could spark a conflagration. Simply declaring your patriotism by wearing a military uniform while black could be enough. Between 1877 and 1950, thousands of black veterans suffered brutal abuse at the hands of white vigilante mobs who viewed black military service as an offensive and threatening assertion of equal citizenship. Many of those assaults resulted in lynchings. Black economic success could prove deadly too, such as in Tulsa, Oklahoma in 1921. When a mob composed of more than 2,000 white men and women commenced a devastating pogrom in the city's thriving Greenwood district, known as Black Wall Street, killing as many as 300 people and burning more than 35 blocks of black homes and businesses to the ground. The attack rendered 10,000 black people homeless and caused more than $2 million in damage. Simply daring to smile at a white woman could get you killed as well. Emmett Till, a 14-year-old black boy, was murdered in Mississippi in 1955 because he allegedly flirted with a white woman. As historian Carol Anderson observes in White Rage, the mere presence of black people was not the problem. The problem was blackness with ambition, with drive, with purpose, with aspirations, and with demands for full and equal citizenship. Just as in the days of the Haitian Revolution and before, nothing frightened and enraged white people more than black people who were determined to be free. After the civil rights movement began, a fresh wave of white terrorism washed over those who had the audacity to organize for freedom and equality. Between the 1940s and 1970s, white vigilantes and mobs, frequently with the support or direct involvement of the police, attacked civil rights activists in Selma, Little Rock, Boston, Chicago, New Orleans, and scores of other cities and towns across the country as they protested legalized segregation in housing and schools, on buses and trains, and at lunch counters and beyond. Protesters were killed, beaten, attacked by police dogs, and arrested en masse for desegregating buses and trains, marching peacefully for voting rights, and demonstrating against the Jim Crow regime. State and federal authorities were complicit, defining their mission to include the monitoring and sabotage of black leaders, activists, and organizations. Most famously, the FBI's notorious counterintelligence program, COINTELPRO, targeted Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, Stokely Carmichael, later known as Kwame Ture, and others, subjecting them to tactics adopted from military counterintelligence that a Senate Intelligence Committee later found would be intolerable in a democratic society, even if all of the targets had been involved in violent activity. As explained in that committee's report, published in 1976, COINTELPRO functioned as a sophisticated vigilante operation aimed squarely at preventing the exercise of First Amendment rights of speech and association, on the theory that preventing the growth of dangerous groups and the propagation of dangerous ideas would protect the national security. The unstated premise of COINTELPRO operations was that activism challenging racial, social, and economic injustice was dangerous, and that a law enforcement agency has the duty to do whatever is necessary to combat perceived threats to the existing social and political order. Over the course of 15 years, under the leadership of FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover, COINTELPRO infiltrated numerous organizations devoted to Black freedom, such as the Black Panther Party, harassing, imprisoning, torturing, and even murdering its members, including Fred Hampton. By the late 1960s, many Black activists and young people had reached their breaking point, no longer willing to tolerate abusive law enforcement and white vigilante violence, and no longer willing to subscribe to nonviolence as a social philosophy or political strategy, as preached by Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. and others. Although the federal government passed historic civil rights legislation in 1964 and 1965, formally banning race discrimination in voting, employment, and public accommodations, including lunch counters and train stations, which had been sites of protracted nonviolent civil rights protest and struggle, economic conditions in many Black communities were dire and worsening. Many gains achieved through the civil rights movement seemed largely symbolic to Black people who were subject to pervasive police violence and trapped in segregated, impoverished ghettos that had been created by white racism and government action. King himself acknowledged this dilemma, wondering aloud shortly before his death, "What good is having the right to sit at a lunch counter if you can't afford to buy a hamburger?" When King was assassinated on April 4, 1968, profound despair and grief swept Black communities nationwide, and violent rebellions erupted in more than 200 cities. In what came to be known as the Holy Week Uprising, thousands of people were injured, scores killed, and hundreds of buildings looted or burned, marking the nation's greatest wave of social unrest since the Civil War. While many civil rights leaders pleaded for peace in the streets, insisting that any form of violent rebellion would dishonor King's memory and legacy, others refused to condemn the violence. Floyd McKissick, the National Director of the Congress of Racial Equality, CORE, told the New York Times on the night of King's murder that his death meant the end of nonviolence as a political strategy. "Nonviolence is a dead philosophy, and it was not the Black people that killed it. It was the white people that killed nonviolence, and white racists at that." That sentiment was echoed by other Black activists and leaders, such as Julius Hobson, who headed a civil rights group called ACT. "The next Black man who comes into the Black community preaching nonviolence should be violently dealt with by the Black people who hear him. The Martin Luther King concept of nonviolence died with him. It was a foreign ideology anyway, as foreign to this violent country as speaking Russian." A wave of Black rebellion rocked the United States in the months and years that followed. Roughly 2,000 uprisings occurred between May 1968 and December 1972, nearly all of which were sparked by routine police violence. As the historian Elizabeth Hinton explains in America on Fire, virtually every major urban center burned during those 4 years. Violence flared up not only in archetypal ghettos, including Harlem and Watts, and in majority Black cities, such as Detroit and Washington, D.C., It appeared in Greensboro, North Carolina, and Gary, Indiana, and Seattle, Washington, and countless places in between. Every city, small or large, where black residents lived in segregated, unequal conditions. This was not a surge of purposeless criminality, as many white observers claimed. It was a sustained revolt. Throughout American history, white mob violence had been understood as thoroughly political in nature. It was obvious to everyone concerned that white people frequently became enraged when their status or power was threatened, and that they were willing to maintain the racial order through violence, including burning buildings, looting homes, and attacking or lynching black people. But when black rebellions swept our nation, they were cast as deviant, criminal, and irrational. Hinton observes, it was only when white people no longer appeared to be the driving force behind rioting in the nation's cities, and when black collective violence against exploitative and repressive institutions surfaced, that riots came to be seen as purely criminal and completely senseless acts. Some experts and politicians during that period did acknowledge that the desperate and unjust conditions in which millions of black people lived were at least partly to blame for the uprisings, most notably the members of the Kerner Commission, which had been created by President Lyndon Johnson to investigate the causes of highly destructive and deadly rioting that had occurred in Detroit and Newark in 1967. The commission's initial report, released just weeks before King was killed, concluded that severe segregation, poverty, joblessness, lack of access to housing, lack of access to economic opportunities, and discrimination in the job market, combined with pervasive police violence and harassment, had created a tinderbox of rage and despair that would certainly result in more uprisings if drastic action was not taken. The report found that many white people were in denial about the true causes of black uprisings, but black people were not. What white Americans have never fully understood, but what the Negro can never forget, is that white society is deeply implicated in the ghetto. White institutions created it, white institutions maintain it, and white society condones it. Conservative white people mostly rejected the Kerner Commission's report, preferring to place responsibility for the widespread political violence directly and solely on the black community and an imagined culture of lawlessness that had been encouraged by civil rights protests. Throughout the civil rights movement, conservative politicians like Richard Nixon argued that the increasing crime rate was not caused by poverty or joblessness, but instead can be traced directly to the spread of the corrosive doctrine that every citizen possesses an inherent right to decide for himself which laws to obey and when to disobey them. Others went further, insisting that integration causes crime. That type of fear-mongering failed to prevent the passage of major civil rights legislation in 1964 and 1965. But the imagery associated with the rebellions, as well as the scale and scope of the destruction, helped fuel the racist argument that civil rights for black people led to rampant crime and disorder. Many white people pointed to the images on their television screens as black people burned buildings or looted stores and claimed that white people had good reason to fear the changes that were being forced upon them and that black people must be controlled at any cost. What was happening in the streets was criminal, they argued, nothing more and nothing less. President Johnson was not among those who denied that legitimate reasons existed for the rebellions. Echoing Thomas Jefferson more than a century after he'd warned of the dangers of holding a wolf by the ear, Johnson said of the uprisings that followed the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., "What did you expect? I don't know why we're so surprised. When you put your foot on a man's neck and hold him down for 300 years, and then you let him up, what's he going to do? He's going to knock your block off. In a July 1967 speech about black rebellions in Detroit and Newark, he condemned the violence as criminal, but also admitted that the only genuine long-range solution for what has happened lies in an attack, mounted at every level, upon the conditions that breed despair and violence. Like many liberals, Johnson's rhetoric indicated that he favored social programs to address root causes of black despair. But in practice, he, as well as both political parties, increasingly looked to law enforcement as the best strategy to achieve and maintain law and order. The Kerner Commission, in its final report, which became a best-selling book in 1968, warned against this lopsided approach, saying that absent a massive investment in poor black communities, rebellion and white retaliation would render racial inequality a permanent feature of American life. That warning was largely ignored. White fears of losing political, economic, and social dominance, combined with fears of unruly, rebellious black people, led to massive investments and punitive control over black people, rather than massive investments that might have repaired the harm caused by centuries of racial oppression. For more than four decades, our nation has declared wars on drugs and crime, invested billions of dollars in highly militarized police forces, and embarked on a race to incarcerate in black communities while slashing funding from education, drug treatment, public housing, and welfare. The result has been disastrous. The United States now has the highest rate of incarceration in the world. The number of people behind bars has quintupled in the past four decades, while the black-white economic divide is as wide as it was in 1968. In recent years, politicians have defended mass incarceration on the grounds that getting tough on crime was what black people wanted. In other words, that black fear, not white fear, drove the phenomenon. This is a partial truth. Desperate to address rising crime rates largely caused by the disappearance of work in segregated, ghettoized communities, some black people have, over the years, supported and advocated for mandatory minimum sentences and other harsh policies. Other black people, including civil rights activists and organizations, have strenuously opposed crime legislation that propels mass incarceration. The NAACP called the Draconian Crime Bill, championed by President Bill Clinton in 1994, a crime against the American people. Yet black voices challenging the prison-building boom and demanding investments in education, full employment, drug treatment, and affordable housing were ignored. As Elizabeth Hinton wrote with the historian Julili Kohler Hausman and the political scientist Veshla M. Weaver in a New York Times opinion piece in 2016, it's not just that those demands were ignored completely. It's that some elements were elevated and others were diminished, what we call selective hearing. Policymakers pointed to black support for greater punishment and surveillance, without recognizing accompanying demands to redirect power and economic resources to low-income minority communities. Rather than focus on root causes of crime and violence and the systems and structures that create and maintain inequality, politicians across the political spectrum capitulated to a narrative that segregationists had been selling decades earlier, and that enslavers had embraced before them, namely, that black people were lazy, had to be forced to work, were inherently or culturally criminal, and thus must be subject to perpetual control. This narrative made it easy to rationalize draconian punishments, as well as stop and frisk and surveillance tactics, not unlike those employed by slave patrollers more than a century ago. In choosing this path, liberal and conservative politicians proved that they could hear loud and clear reactionary white voices belonging to what some media pundits and politicians dubbed the angry white men, people who viewed racial and social justice as a zero-sum game they were afraid to lose, even as they claimed not to hear black people pleading with their representatives to take the road less traveled and to end the cycle of racial oppression, rebellion, and punitive control once and for all. This problem of selective hearing of black voices might be dismissed as a profound misunderstanding if it did not fit so neatly into a recurring pattern dating back to our nation's founding. The impulse to resist efforts by black people to gain freedom and equality and to respond with punishment or violence, no matter whether demands are made through peaceful protest, lobbying, or outright rebellion, has been the defining feature of black-white race relations since the first slave ships arrived on American shores. This habitual impulse has been driven by chronic fear, not just of black people, because similar responses can be found in post-colonial dealings with other racial groups and indigenous communities, but more deeply of what true justice might require. Considering this history, it should have come as no surprise that the election of the first black president and anxiety over shifting racial demographics due to immigration, including a widely publicized projection that white people will be a racial minority by the mid-21st century, would be followed by a rise in white nationalism, hate crimes, and vigilante violence, as well as the election of politicians like Donald Trump, a man who rose to power by exploiting racial fears and divisions and sought to maintain power by thwarting democracy. In the same vein, it should have been obvious that rebellions in black communities would sweep our nation again and again, given that police officers and vigilantes continue to kill unarmed black people like Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, and George Floyd, and given that the deplorable conditions documented in the Kerner Commission's report remain mostly unaddressed. While some black people have benefited from the social and policy changes brought by the civil rights movement, in many respects, things have gotten worse for black communities since that report was published, with so many more black people in prison, on probation or parole, and subject to legal discrimination due to criminal records. What does come as a surprise, a welcome one, is that in 2020, the predictable cycle, white fear and violence followed by uprisings and rebellions that lead to white reprisals, retaliation, and strengthening of systems of control, didn't play out exactly as usual. Instead, the largest racial justice protests in history, including people of all colors and ages and from all walks of life, occurred during the Trump presidency, after a major black rebellion and in the midst of a global pandemic. Protesters carried aloft signs saying, "Black Lives Matter," and "Defund the Police," reflecting the understanding that so long as we continue to invest in the types of punitive systems of organized violence that have oppressed and controlled black people for centuries, rather than in the programs, policies, and forms of structural change that black communities need to thrive, we will never achieve a truly inclusive, egalitarian democracy that honors the dignity and value of black lives. James Baldwin famously said, "Not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed unless it is faced." Perhaps our nation is finally beginning to face our history as a new generation of activists challenges us to choose a radically different path forward. The future of black communities and our democracy as a whole depends on us finally getting it right this time.